joining us today for his monthly appearance as contractually obligated by a totally different company is our friend Will Brinson of CBS. Will, how are you?
Bill, I'm doing well. What if we had let it slide? I don't know what the contract states. I'd have to have my fictional attorney look at it. But if I missed November, would I then be contractually obligated for two in December? It'd be fine with me. I like talking to you about football. So I'm cool either way. But good to talk to you, and happy early Thanksgiving. Get pretty pumped for a little tryptophan and Trubisky-induced nap on Thursday afternoon.
The answer, Will, is that if you had not done my podcast, I would have shown up at your house on the last day of November, and I would have forced you to talk about football. That's just how it goes. You got to be prepared in these podcast streets. An interesting Thanksgiving Day slate to come, of course, with the Bears playing the Lions, Bills, Cowboys, and Saints-Falcons, a possible Saints revenge game. We saw yesterday the Falcons defense might not be all that it was cracked up to be after the prior 2 weeks in the Buccaneers win over Atlanta. But we're going to get to three games that were, in my opinion, really interesting in different ways. I think we learned a lot about several teams and maybe a lot about several coaches. But we're going to get to a couple of those games in a minute. Let's start, Will, with the Sunday night game. Let's talk about the 49ers and the Packers. The game I compared this to when I was recording this week's episode of ESPN Daily with Mina Kimes last night was the Seahawks-Broncos Super Bowl, a game that you'd be surprised Mina remembers in vivid detail. It felt like a sort of game where the Niners came out in the first drive, they dominate the Packers, they get a strip sack, set themselves up for a short field, and it felt like that was the setting the tone and tenor of the game from that point forward. So, were you surprised with just how dominant the 49ers defense was in this game, Will?
Well, one, Bill, I don't believe that we're allowed to say setting the tone. That is not a friendly term. I actually think it is. Like, you want to be, you know, you want to, it's not established. I don't know. I feel like setting the tone could be like how you come out and be aggressive and all that. So I think it actually works. Two, I agree completely, and I like that comparison. I will never forget. I mean, just I can picture it in my mind. I mean, the hit that Cam Chancellor laid in the first series, and I had picked the Broncos to beat the Seahawks, incorrectly. But like when that hit happened, it's like, well, this game's over.
It's true.
These are two teams playing at different speeds. You can just tell, and you felt that way early on. With San Francisco, their defense really came to play. I had picked the 49ers to win big, so I was pleased with the early outcome.
There we go.
I didn't think the offense was necessarily outstanding. They had two big plays, one 61-yard pass to George Kittle, got wide open, perfectly schemed. The other great catch and run by Deebo Samuel for a 42-yard touchdown. I'm not saying take those away and look at Jimmy G's numbers, but, you know, I mean, he was very efficient and made the throws he needed to make. He overcame sort of a jumpy start. Mm-hmm. But it was really the defense that carried this team once again. And that's not a knock on the offense. The offense has developed in sort of different ways, and I think still has yet to really hit its stride. And that's what's scary about this 49ers team is if they get going offensively, they can really be a behemoth in the playoffs. But, yeah, I mean, the defense – was all over the place. The Packers had seven drives of 10 yards or less in the first two quarters of this game. I mean, that is pretty stunning. Two of those were for negative yards. They punted six times. They had a fumble on that first drive. Mm-hmm. And you just never felt like, you know, like with the Cowboys and the Patriots game, which we'll talk about, you felt like the Patriots were winning fairly handily, but then you would look at the score and the Cowboys were down 4 points.
Right.
This is like the opposite of that. The 49ers were just never in danger of losing that game, and those of us were hoping for, I don't know, maybe four more points out of the outcome of this game were disappointed by the Packers' inability to score. One point that I saw noted, I'm not sure where it was. It was on Twitter, so apologies to whoever pointed it out, but sure. I'm taking it and I'm rolling with it as if it's my own, and I'm getting credit for it. But I feel like the person who noted this might be smart enough to listen to your podcast, so I don't want to go on the story. The two worst games for Aaron Rodgers were in California, and they were against Bosa brothers. But more importantly, they were against Gus Bradley and Robert Saleh, who are former Seattle acolytes of Pete Carroll. And I sort of, you know, I don't think Rodgers has this history of getting thrashed by the Seahawks, so I almost wonder if it's maybe a Matt LaFleur Seattle zone, you know, high zone, you know, zone cover three type of thing that might be creating the issues there. I don't know. I mean, maybe the defenses are just good, but I did find that connection very interesting.
That is really interesting. And I think what I really found striking about this game was, yeah, the pass rush was great. For the vast majority of this game, the pass rush was really threatening. And of course, the Packers losing Brian Bulaga really hurt. Of course. I mean, obviously that's a, you know, you're replacing a franchise right tackle with, Alex Blight, who is, you know, a guy. And that's not, it's going to be an enormous drop off. That's not a surprise to anybody. What I didn't find surprising, but what I found really promising for the 49ers on defense is that so many times in this game, Aaron Rodgers did have time to throw, or he was able to escape the pressure and roll out. Nobody was getting open. I mean, time after time after time. It wasn't just the first thrust of, oh, this is what this play is going to be, but also in the sort of improvisational drills, it was, oh, nobody's getting open. I mean, the guys the Niners have in coverage are holding up for 4 or 5 seconds in coverage, and that's really, really remarkable. I mean, there was that one fourth down where Aaron Jones kind of slipped away from the blocking and, you know, picked up 20 yards, but really that was the exception. Even on the one touchdown drive the Packers had in this game, a lot of the yardage they got was from penalties.
For sure. And, like, on that touchdown drive, it was 23-0. I mean, it felt like that. It felt, I mean, eerily similar to that touchdown drive against the Chargers, where it's like, well, that's cool. You scored. The game's still over. It's like, I understand the game is not over because, you know, there's plenty of time left technically, but it did not feel as if there was any real chance that with 350 left in the third quarter that the Packers were going to come back from that. And I sort of wonder, Bill, too, like, has Matt LaFleur, I don't want to criticize Matt LaFleur's offense because it has worked very well at times. It does feel like when Davante Adams plays and is healthy, they're trying to force feed him targets as opposed to maybe, like, their offense was at its best when they were letting Aaron Rodgers pass these running backs and their big runs. And I almost wonder if they're not kind of getting back to force feeding Davante Adams. I also sort of wonder about the ability of this team to come back from a big deficit. Like, that's always kind of been a hallmark of Aaron Rodgers, right? You never felt like it was over until it ended. He could always bring you back, and it just doesn't feel like this team can come back quickly from a big deficit, at least against a, you know, an upper echelon defense of sorts, if we're willing to classify the Chargers as that, which I guess we can do. I think maybe like 23rd in DVOA, but they're not good, but they got a great pass rush.
Yeah. I mean, they came back against the Lions. But like you said, the Lions are the Lions. This is not a, you know, that is not a top flight defense by any means. I would not want to put the Lions in that discussion. And I think there's something really interesting about how this offense works and how it's constructed. And at least to me, it feels like the most important player in this offense, even maybe beyond Aaron Rodgers, is Aaron Jones. I put the on-off splits in my column last week. I don't know if they still apply because the Packers didn't do anything right in this game. But with Aaron Jones on the field, the Packers are the best offense in football. And with Jamal Williams on the field, they're the Giants offense, which is, I'm going to let you in on the secret, Will. The Giants offense is bad. You don't want to emulate the Giants offense in any way, shape, or form. Whereas with Davante Adams, they've been better throwing the football with Davante Adams on the sidelines. And I'm not saying they should bench Davante Adams. Of course not. I'm not going to be a dum-dum. But what I will say is that I think this offense works best when Aaron Jones is the focal part of the offense and he's playing a ton of snaps. And I sort of brought up this point of, I think at some point, to get this offense going, which it has not looked good since maybe the Chiefs game, you know, over the last 3 weeks, the Chargers, the Panthers, the Niners, this offense has been pretty mediocre over the last three games. There has to come a point where Aaron Jones just becomes the guy and he's on the field 85% of the time because this offense just is so much fundamentally better with him on the field. I don't think it's the next 2 weeks because you have the Giants and Washington and a lot of offenses are going to look good against those defenses. But that final three game stretch and for the playoffs to come, Bears, Vikings, Lions, and then the playoffs afterwards, I think the Packers have to go with a huge dose of Aaron Jones, even if it means running the ball more frequently than an Aaron Rodgers-led offense would typically run the ball.
Yeah, and I think you're right about the next 2 weeks. It's fascinating, too, how the chasm that sort of feels like was built between, and they're just two and a half games because you have the head-to-head, but now it feels, to me at least, that was sort of the finality I felt in that, not the finality, but the difference in that game, that now Green Bay went from, okay, let's go out and win as a dog on the road on Sunday night in San Francisco, let's take the number one seed, to, whoa, we need to win this division. Like, because the Vikings are on a bye, and they're at Seattle, and it's Kirk Cousins versus Russell Wilson in primetime. I'm sure that'll be on Twitter and in real life. But, you know, the Vikings have plenty of, you know, winnable games. I mean, they get the Seahawks, Lions, Chargers, and then the Packers. And the Packers now have the Giants, Washington, Chicago, and Minnesota. So, I mean, like, if you're Green Bay, you should still feel good about your chances of winning the division. It's probably going to come down to like the NFC East, a head-to-head matchup in Week 16 at Minnesota, a place where Aaron Rodgers has, you know, typically played well throughout his career, although maybe less so, I guess, in the new stadium. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I mean, it just felt like – and it's not over. I mean, the Packers have two very winnable games in front of them, but it felt like the quest for home field advantage throughout the playoffs may have just flown out the window, and now it's more about being defensive and, okay, can this offense get going – and, you know, you need to see it against Washington and New York. And we should see it. But you need to see it to know that they can make a push in those final three divisional games.
Yeah. For the Packers, according to the New York Times Upshot Interactive, if they win against the Vikings in Week 16, throwing everything else out of the equation, their chances of winning the division rise from 65% to 91%. If they lose... Sure. Fall from 65%, excuse me, down to 44%. So, I mean, obviously, that is going to be an absolutely key game, which should be no surprise, but I think more so now than it was a couple weeks ago. In terms of the Niners, I mean, did this change anything about how you feel about them in terms of how they're positioned at the top of the conference? I think, you know, given their schedule, which does get tougher, I mean, Ravens, Saints over the next couple of weeks, Rams still to come, a trip to the Seahawks in Week 17, but did it make you buy them any more as possibly the best team in the conference? If they do, you know, even given that they are probably going to be the one seed, does it sort of change your sort of view of what their ceiling is?
No, I don't think it does. I mean, like I said, we haven't seen the offense start clicking, right? I mean, really click yet. I mean, like, it's had its moments, and they've been great against the Cardinals in, you know, two games, and that's great for Jimmy Garoppolo, but we have not seen this offense take off. So I do think there is some more upside from an offensive perspective. Defensively, they really need to stay healthy. I think that's key. I mean, that's great advice. Like, you know what? You should stay alive. don't get hurt. I feel like they've been pretty fortunate. I guess Quan Alexander got hurt, and now Dee Ford's banged up. So maybe they haven't been that fortunate. They're playing awesome on defense. I just think when I look at the NFC, if you told me that Minnesota, Seattle, or Dallas, and those are your 4, 5, 6 teams, went to San Francisco and won a divisional round playoff game against the 49ers, I wouldn't be shocked, because I think that those teams are good enough to do it. We've seen Seattle do it. I believe in Minnesota. I'm not sure the matchup is great with that offensive line and San Fran's defensive line. And then Dallas, I think, you know, I'm sure they'll find a way to screw it up, but I think they could go win. Whereas, you know, if you told me that a wild card team, and I'll take Kansas City out of this because they're the 4 seed, because sure, I would believe Mahomes going to New England. But if you told me the 5 or 6 seed in the AFC went to New England and won, I would laugh at you, because I don't think that's happening. So, yes, I think the 49ers established themselves as the best team in the conference, but I'm not sure that the gap is as big from 1 to 6 as it is on the other side of the bracket. And you know, we'll see. I mean, San Francisco is going to New Orleans in 2 weeks. They're at Baltimore next week. Baltimore's supposed to be, I think the early line is 4.5-point favorite. And so San Francisco is going to be really tested. You win the next 2 weeks, and revise this to say, yes, they are hands down the best team in the conference and maybe the best team in football. Big 2 weeks coming, but yeah, yes, short answer, yes, I think they're the best team in the conference, but I think it's a very small gap down to the next two teams.
I agree with that. By the way, Jimmy Garoppolo mentioned his performance, 145.8 passer rating in this game. Do you know where he finished in QBR, Will?
Oh, I saw that. I saw someone mention that, and is it really bad?
It's 24. Like, 24. Wow. Worse than Carson Wentz, who had a rough game on Sunday. And I mean,
no, I was gonna say, Carson Wentz had 5 incompletions within 5 yards of the line of scrimmage.
Yeah, that's not great. I mean, you know, Jimmy Garoppolo.
Is it a rushing thing, I guess?
The fumble. Fumble hurt him. He didn't throw a lot of passes, so only 20 pass attempts, so he didn't really have a lot of opportunities to overcome the fumble. Of course, a lot of what he did in terms of yardage was after the catch. I thought he played fine. You know, I don't think I have any major issues with how Jimmy Garoppolo played. I think it's just the one game sample. But yeah, I mean, I don't know that necessarily, you know, this was a sterling performance from Jimmy Garoppolo. And even last week, he put up big numbers in that game, or threw for over 400 yards, if I'm not mistaken, but 2 ugly interceptions in that game as well. So I think there's still, you know, I wouldn't say the jury's still out, but I think just we're getting a sense of where Jimmy Garoppolo is, and it's maybe not quite as good as Niners fans want him to be.
I would say, too, the one thing that I've noticed about him in these games is that shaky start, which is a little surprising for a Kyle Shanahan offense, because you think they'd be a little more scripted and he'd be a little more comfortable. He hadn't looked great early on, and if you get pressured early on, he really starts to look kind of shaky and jittery in the pocket. But the thing that's impressed me is he's settled down as the game has gone along. Mm-hmm. And so I credit the coaching staff and Jimmy for doing it. Like, they change the way they protect him. They change the way they sort of bootleg him out or give him some play-action looks. And they get him those open shots across the middle of the field, at least they did last night. And it really seemed to settle him down. So that's something I would think that's important, you know, from a winning playoff games perspective. I would also throw out, you know, maybe live betting on playoff games. Maybe 49ers get down in a playoff game, you can get them as a big dog. And Jimmy G settles in a little bit more. So just a thought.
Fellas, listen up. If you heard of Manscaped, they offer precision-engineered tools optimized specifically for male grooming and hygiene. Grooming is essential nowadays, but a lot of you are still hesitant to manscape. You're afraid you might cut yourself, and hey, that's understandable. That's why this revolutionary company, Manscaped, has redesigned the electric trimmer. Their Lawnmower 2.0 has proprietary advanced skin-safe technology, so it won't nick or snag your skin. The Lawnmower 2.0 comes inside their Perfect Package 2.0, which makes for a great gift this holiday season. It's literally everything you need for a nick-free manscaping experience every time, and nobody wants a nick around. It's time to gear up and to get all the guys in your life, you, your brother, and your friends, the gift of shaving this holiday season with the Manscaped Perfect Package 2.0. Go to manscaped.com to try the Perfect Package 2.0 and get 20% off and free shipping with discount code Barnwell. That's discount code Barnwell, my last name, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L. Give a great gift this year and get 20% off with free shipping by going to manscaped.com by using promo code Barnwell. Now back to the show. All right, Will. So let's talk about the other big game, or maybe the biggest game of the week on Sunday, I think I would say. Patriots Cowboys, a television ratings dream. Not really a dream in terms of the game we actually saw. There was bad weather in Foxborough, which really seemed to compromise the Cowboys offense. The Patriots offense, not great in general, and certainly did not look especially impressive on Sunday. And of course, we'll get to Jason Garrett's decision and his future in Dallas in a minute. But just in terms of what we saw in this game, what sort of stood out to you as the biggest surprise versus your expectations heading into the contest?
I think this is an odd surprise, but I thought the Patriots ran the ball pretty well.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, all right. I was like, what? I was like, because it wasn't anything really with the weather and the wind and the way it was. I mean, there was no way we were going to see 30 and certainly not 40 points in that game.
Right.
And so it felt like, man, I mean, you know, this is a game. I mean, the coaching, like, I think that's what makes Jerry Jones so upset, is that it's like this game is going to come down to the very small details and the execution in very critical moments that can flip the game. And Belichick's team has it, and Jason Garrett's team doesn't. But the way that, you know, Sony Michel ran the best he's run pretty much all year. I mean, 20 carries for 85 yards. He actually had some open holes. And, you know, Isaiah Wynn was back and had a big push on that final run to really seal the game. So I would probably look at the Patriots running game, because to me, Bill, that is, I think that, I mean, unless there's a secret, you know, cabal of thinkers out there who view differently here, I always sort of thought the Patriots were going to play possum this year with their offense in the first place, with no Gronk and, you know, limited weapons before they, you know, added N'Keal Harry and Jacoby Myers. And I mean, still, we're talking about, you know, not exactly elite options. And Antonio Brown, of course, and before his departure. But right. I sort of thought they would keep the Ferrari in the garage, so to speak, try to get to 12-plus wins, get the first round by, get home field advantage, and then really try and find that formula that worked for them last year, which was aggressively running the football downhill, letting Tom Brady take shots when he can, and then playing great defense. So I sort of feel like they are fairly close to where they want to be, even though I understand that it's probably frustrating for Tom Brady in that offense. But a big, big sign, I thought, to be able to run the ball here.
All right, we'll be back with Will in a second. But first, guys, by this time of year, the planners and the Virgos of the world have checked off everything on their list, while me and the rest of us last-minute people are running around like lunatics trying to figure out what to get everybody. Don't fear, fellow last-minute gifters, because MeUndies has everybody on your list covered. It's the one-stop shopping spot to get gifts that people will actually love. Delivered straight to your door, free shipping, no buts about it. Guys, I have done a lot of ads over the last few years on this show, and I will say there are plenty of people I know who have ordered MeUndies after listening to the show. I don't want to say I'm a great ad reader. I'm okay. I can certainly do better. But I have never once had a single complaint, whether it's one of the people I know personally, whether it's a listener. Everyone I know who has tried MeUndies has loved MeUndies. That's because it's just warm and comfortable. It doesn't feel like anything else you've tried before. And it's the perfect, perfect attire for the non-daylight savings time part of year. When it gets dark at 4 p.m., it is the perfect time to put on your MeUndies in sizes extra small to 4XL with plenty of brand new products. The options for getting cozy are endless. When they say cozy, they mean it, with undies that are three times softer than cotton in the cutest wintry prints and colors, which is extremely, extremely soft. So this holiday season, cozy up in MeUndies' new robes for men and women. You don't have to leave the house. Treat your feet in their soft new slippers, and of course, match the whole family with their cute new baby bodysuit. With brand new holiday prints and cozy new products, MeUndies is a gift for literally everybody on your list. And if that wasn't enough, they have a great offer for listeners to the Bill Barnwell Show. For any first-time purchasers, you get 15% off and free shipping. And if that was not enough, there is a 100% satisfaction guarantee. So you really, really cannot beat this offer. 15% off your first pair, free shipping, and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. To get all of that, go to MeUndies.com/Barnwell to make your purchase. That's promo code Barnwell, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L. Go to MeUndies.com/Barnwell. Now back to the show. I mean, I have to admit, I feel like there are moments in this game where Michel ran for 10 yards in a row and was kind of surprised himself that he was still upright and running.
What is this green stuff ahead of me? Is that the field and space?
Why am I not tasting the dirt right now? What's going on? I'm supposed to get 2 yards a carry. That's me. I thought it was promising from the Patriots by all means. And who knows how much of it was getting Isaiah Wynn back, how much of it was the Cowboys missing Leighton Vander Esch. But I think that's a promising thing for the Patriots. The other surprise, and this is only one play, but Jeff Heath laying the wood. I did not expect that from Jeff Heath in this game, I have to admit.
I would agree. Did not see it either coming. I mean, yeah, I'm with you.
In terms of the Cowboys offense, I think Dak had a bad game. I think it's obviously a great passing defense on the Patriots side of things. Amari Cooper clearly not 100% and shut down into oblivion by Stephon Gilmore, who I think this was his defensive player of the year if you're going to submit an episode of your TV show for consideration, this was his consideration was, I'm going to wipe Amari Cooper off the face of the earth. The thing is, though, you know, last week when they were playing, well, it was the Lions, I believe, Dak Prescott had a plan B. He was able to get the ball to Randall Cobb and Michael Gallup, and here he was not able to do so. And when I think about this from the Patriots defense perspective, the obvious story surrounding the Patriots, the argument that, you know, you heard when you talked about the Patriots as a historical unit was, oh, well, they haven't beat anybody good. They just played terrible offenses. Rain or no rain, this was the number one offense in football by DVOA heading into this week. And they got held to 3 field goals. And I think I wasn't doubting the Patriots defense, but I think this was a, you know, this was a statement game for them as well.
Let me ask you something, Bill. If you've done like a live podcast in Seattle or somewhere,
sure,
right, Paul?
I have.
Seattle?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So you did a live show in Seattle. And, you know, you got producers, you got people at ESPN setting the thing up. I mean, you're not out there, you know, building a tent yourself or whatever. you do some scouting on the location, right?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's going to be outside. Maybe it's outside in March or something. I don't know. Hell, it doesn't matter because you're outside in Seattle. You know what you're going to take into account? That mm-hmm. it might rain. That there might be rain coming down. And what's stunning to me is that it took the interception by Stephon Gilmore, which was an incredible diving interception. I don't know how he managed to like corral that wet ball into his arm as he was flying to the ground. Mm-hmm. But the reason Dak threw a bad pass is because the ball was snapped above his head. He couldn't grip it. It was sort of fumbled. He came down, as Troy Aikman pointed out. You know, you take your eyes off the field as a quarterback, and it really throws you off. And it clearly threw Dak off. He tried to force the ball into Amari Cooper there, and Gilmore made a play. I don't think it was necessarily a bad throw per se. It wasn't a good one, but Gilmore made a play. The problem is, it took them until about, I think that's what the impetus was, to maybe test out a glove. What on, like, you're in New England. In November, like, I knew mm-hmm. ahead of the game that it might rain. And I was thinking that it might cause issues for the quarterbacks to grip the ball and to throw the ball. How on earth could the Cowboys not have tested out this glove situation prior to throwing an interception that would ultimately like put the Patriots in good field position? I really think it. Like, I'm not trying to absolve Dak here, but I just thought the way that Jason Garrett's coaching staff, they treated this game like it was being played in Jerry World. And that the conditions were not a factor, and that they were not going against the best defense in football, and that they were, you know, there was no sense of understanding about how important each of these little plays, like getting the punt off when the Patriots screwed up and didn't have anybody back to return it, or maybe they were just trying mm-hmm. to block it, of when they kicked the 29-yard field goal late, and we can talk about the decision specifically in a second, but there were so many opportunities within the game, specifically on first and second and third down, to set up short fourth downs that could give them opportunities in the red zone to score. And it felt like a basic failure of understanding football, that you don't need to get a touchdown on first and seven or second and seven. You need to get yourself in a position where you can get a first down, melt the clock, and get in the end zone, because points are at such a premium in this environment. And turnovers are at such a premium. It just didn't feel like there was a grasp of that. It was very bothersome.
Let's get to Jason Garrett and his decision making.
I left Dak, and I'm writing about this right now. And you go back and watch it, and it's kind of mind blowing.
You are 100% right. You are absolutely 100% right. I'm not arguing with you in the slightest, and I think it.
No, I think you are. I just it's unbelievable. It's like they didn't prepare for this game in Foxborough.
Well. Jerry Jones has some thoughts on this, and we'll get to them and Jason Garrett's future after the break here on the Bill Barnwell Show. Back here on the Bill Barnwell Show, I am Bill Barnwell, joined by CBS's Will Brinson. Will, before the break, you were talking about Jason Garrett's lack of preparation, which I think is really interesting, given that the quarterback for whom he was a backup was Troy Aikman, who was doing the color commentary for this game, and even he was like, yeah, gloves have come a long way since I was playing, and they're pretty good now. So it's not as if Jason Garrett should have a good excuse for not knowing that there was glove opportunities to be had and to prepare accordingly for this game. And I think it wasn't just the glove, but as you mentioned, his decision-making. in this game was so frustrating and so difficult. And I think rarely do I see a moment where everybody on the internet agrees on something. There is almost always at least some subset of people who hold out and say, no, actually, this thing that everyone thinks is bad, I thought was good. Maybe I'm the holdout because I had Brett Maher as my kicker yesterday. I forgot to take him out before the weather became clear in Foxborough. He did fine, thankfully to Jason Garrett and his decision making. But I feel like the entire internet agreed that Jason Garrett kicking a field goal in that situation was bad.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny. I'm not like a deep level analytics. I'm just not good enough. I would love to be, but I mean, like, I'm not running the algorithm at Edge Sports, right?
Sure.
But I do get the newsletter. I get the email from Edge Sports, but I thought it was funny. They're like, you know, actually everyone's freaking out about this. It was only, like a 0.5% chance, like the field goal there only hurt their chances by 0.5%. Mm-hmm. And they all considered we leaned slightly toward the first down attempt, but would definitely not label this as a blunder. In fact, it doesn't even qualify as one of the top three fourth down decision errors of the games by the Cowboys. Mm-hmm. And see, that's where you sort of lose me a little bit, because not the Edge thing, but like the Cowboys had a 4th-and-3 at the Pats 28-yard line. Mm-hmm. And they kicked in the second quarter down 10-0. I mean, you got to go there with that distance. They had a 4th-and-1 on their own 37 and punted, trailing 10-6 with 7 minutes left in the third quarter. You can run the ball on this team. You have Dak Prescott. Have him leap, dive into the middle. You're going to get it.
You have Zeke.
Yes. Like, why did you pay Zeke? If not, then why did you pay Zeke? And then on they punted on 4th-and-1 of the opening drive. That was actually those are the two biggest ones. Mm-hmm. But as I pointed out, like, my concern is that when the Cowboys got into the red zone, right? We saw them after the long Randall Cobb pass from their own 16. It's 47 yards. He fumbles and he ends up picking it up and he gets to New England's 25. So they're mm-hmm. basically right out of the red zone. They then ran the end around,
yes,
sort of shovel pass to Tony Pollard, which, if I were trying to draw up a play that would potentially turn the ball over to my opponent, that would almost be the number one play, except the Cowboys then later ran the number one play, which was an option run left with Dak to Zeke at the last moment. I mean, those are plays you install as kitchen sink, we got to beat the Pats plays. Mm-hmm. But then when you see the weather, you have to take them out of the playbook. Yeah. And I don't know if that's Kellen Moore or Jason Garrett, but they run those plays and then they're stuck in 2nd-and-7 and they have to take a shot to the end zone in double coverage with Jason Witten, except you didn't have to. You could have tried to pick up 2 or 3 yards knowing that you're down 7, knowing you need to get that first down. They took another shot to the end zone with Blake Jarwin on 3rd-and-7. And at that point, it's 4th-and-7. It's almost like Jason Garrett wanted to kick. The whole sequence from the second Randall Cobb was down to the field goal going through was just infuriatingly bizarre.
Yeah. And I think the tough part is, you know, the argument is, oh, well, they need a field goal and they need a touchdown. You need more than 7 points. You're down 13-6. That's fine. I think in a different game, I wouldn't be too concerned about kicking. If it were a few yards deeper, wouldn't be concerned about kicking. And I know that Edge Sports does account for some of this stuff, but I do think the specifics of this game situation made it more difficult for the Cowboys. Their number one receiver is not playing well. He is either injured or it has been erased out of existence, like I said, by Stephon Gilmore. So you don't have that guy. He made a nearly great catch on the 4th-and-11 on the final drive, but wasn't able to bring it in. So you've had no success moving the ball for most of this game. You get one big play on the Randall Cobb catch on what was a perfect throw from Dak on a day where he was certainly not perfect. Like you said, the play calling afterwards, strange and bizarre. And, you know, I'm inclined to blame that on Kellen Moore more so than Jason Garrett. But the fourth down decision, this is an issue that Jason Garrett has had for a decade. I mean, I remember writing about his issues in late game decisions on Grantland. And it wasn't in the early days of Grantland. It's been for years and years and years, he has been so incurious about his fourth down decisions. And I mean, I can tell you, there was a year at the Sloan Conference at MIT where I was giving a talk, where I was on a panel, and I brought up Jason Garrett and his fourth down decision making, and people kind of chuckled. And then afterwards, I think I brought it up as an example of what not to do. I think there had been a conspicuous play where he had done something wrong. Afterwards, who did I see walking around but Jason Garrett, who was surely in the crowd for the football analytics panel. So number one, I felt bad because I'm a human being and I don't want to make fun of a nice, smart, Ivy League graduate to his face. I don't want to be mean. I don't think I was mean, but obviously necessarily doesn't feel great if you come all the way for this conference and then some jokester makes fun of you, for making bad decision making. But he hasn't improved. This is not a new thing for Jason Garrett. I do agree with you. It felt like he wanted to kick the field goal from that first point. And given the weather, given how his team has played for the entirety of this game, which I think is usually overrated, but not in this situation because it had been so dramatic in this drive versus any of the other drives, I have to fault Jason Garrett. I think that it's worse than the half of 1% that the Edge Sports analytics are suggesting given this specific situation. And I mean, I'm not the only one. You know, Jerry Jones, after this game, I can't recall. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm not a completist of Jerry Jones quotes, but I can't recall him being so aggressively dismissive of Jason Garrett's efforts. And
you're 100% correct.
It was really staggering.
He usually goes out of his way to use this like circumvential Arkansas
Texarkana
lingo slang. Yeah, Texarkana lingo slang that like takes you to a place where you don't really know what he said, but it's kind of vague, but he sort of said something. He got in his, you could see it in his eyes too, and he got right to the point, and he mentioned coaching. And it was like that Tom Curran tweet when he showed the Brown sideline versus the Patriots sideline. The problem is when you're doing a bad job coaching and you're doing it against Bill Belichick, it's a little more stark, you know?
It is. It really is. And he's not going to get Bill Belichick, but I wonder if this is him sort of, you know, laying the groundwork for promoting Kellen Moore, who you'd figure is going to get head coaching inquiries this offseason, whether it's hiring a flashy coach. Lincoln Riley, of course, has been the sort of popularly linked one, although I don't know if that's necessarily going to happen. But, you know, it felt like Jerry Jones was laying cover if Jason Garrett doesn't win out and end up winning the NFC. It's not that he has to win out, but just that, you know, unless Jason Garrett has a sort of end to the season that inspires Jerry Jones to give him a new deal. Because you have to remember, Jerry Jones did not extend Jason Garrett after that run to the playoffs a year ago.
I mean, this is, I think my colleague Jared Dubin at CBS maybe said it best on Twitter. He said, this is a 9-2 team with 2-9 coaching. And what you end up is 6-5. Like that's sort of where you get there. And like, it's not all on Jason Garrett. I mean, there's been poor execution in some spots and, you know, but like, this is a game that, you know, the Patriots are not, I mean, the Patriots are vulnerable. I thought the Patriots were coming into this game. I wanted to pick the Cowboys to win, but I wouldn't because of the coaching mismatch. I thought that with what the Cowboys' strengths are and what the Patriots' weaknesses are, that this aligned perfectly for Dallas to go in there and steal a victory in weird conditions against a vulnerable Patriots team that certainly has some strengths, but like, you know, you can attack them. And we saw the Ravens with smart coaching and great game planning attack them in a way that put them in a position where they had to get off of what they wanted to do. I mean, the Patriots players talked afterwards about how they were playing from ahead and how big that was for them because they could try to run the ball. They didn't have to wing it around. And, you know, I mean, I thought Tom Brady actually played fairly well despite whatever the stats are. I mean, just the condition, 17-37, 190 and a touchdown. I mean, nobody was going to come out of there with a pristine stat line. And so I thought Brady played fairly well, all things considering. And I think you got the sense that they knew the scope of what needed to be done to win in the context of where they were playing. And it felt, again, like the Cowboys were just preparing for a random home game on a Thursday and with no context about who they were going against. And it boils down to that decision too, right? Like, again, I agree with you. I know the edge thing says 0.5. I mean, it's higher because it is the Patriots. You are in the red zone. The conditions are bad. You're giving Tom Brady and Bill Belichick a chance to close you out. You can put them on the defensive by going in there and getting a touchdown and being aggressive. And it just felt like the whole game throughout, it was poorly coached.
Yeah, absolutely.
For the record, I think that the Giants should absolutely hire Jason Garrett for comedy's sake. I know, I'm sorry. But I do think that Jerry Jones, I know that I think it was the first episode of ESPN Daily, right, with Don Van Natta and Mina, I think the concept's so cool, like you're talking about, you know, the broader spectrum of what exists outside of this Cowboys win over the Eagles, not the specifics of it. And, you know, Don, who has knows Jerry very well and has reported on him at length over the past years and wrote about him in a recent story with Seth Wickersham, pointed out repeatedly that Jerry Jones is desperate. And we all know that.
Sure.
But I think we can't undersell that when it comes to what Jerry Jones will be willing to do this offseason in terms of moving on from Jason Garrett if he doesn't get them to at least like the NFC Championship game. And then going out and spending who knows how much to bring in Lincoln Riley or whoever it is.
Fellas, listen up. If you heard of Manscaped, they offer precision-engineered tools optimized specifically for male grooming and hygiene. Grooming is essential nowadays, but a lot of you are still hesitant to manscape. You're afraid you might cut yourself, and hey, that's understandable. That's why this revolutionary company, Manscaped, has redesigned the electric trimmer. Their Lawnmower 2.0 has proprietary advanced skin-safe technology, so it won't nick or snag your skin. The Lawnmower 2.0 comes inside their Perfect Package 2.0, which makes for a great gift this holiday season. It's literally everything you need for a nick-free manscaping experience every time, and nobody wants a nick around. It's time to gear up and to get all the guys in your life, you, your brother, and your friends, the gift of shaving this holiday season with the Manscaped Perfect Package 2.0. Go to manscaped.com to try the Perfect Package 2.0 and get 20% off and free shipping with discount code Barnwell. That's discount code Barnwell, my last name, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L. Give a great gift this year and get 20% off with free shipping by going to manscaped.com by using promo code Barnwell. Now back to the show. How much do you think Jerry Jones will be willing to offer Bill Belichick per year?
$50 million, and I'm not kidding.
I think I had 35 in my head, and I think if he said 35 and Belichick said 50, he would not bat an eye. He would hand it over in a suitcase.
Yeah. He'd be like, you want a 10-year deal or a 5-year deal or a 10-year? Yeah. I mean, sure, because look, I mean, I get it. Jerry Jones is we have for the past 20 years established the idea that Jerry Jones didn't win like Jimmy Johnson won the Super Bowls. You know, Jerry bought the team and that's great. And he's a marketing genius and a business savant and all of that. And he's a hell of a negotiator and a hell of a businessman. But at the end of the day, with Jerry as GM, this team hasn't won a Super Bowl. And, so, you know, you haven't won it since Jimmy Johnson's players were gone and since Barry Switzer was gone. So I think it is he wants more than anything to be the one who finds the players, who finds the coach, who finds the quarterback to go win the Super Bowl. And I think that's why Jason Garrett's been here so long, is the former Cowboys backup, and he got Dak, who replaced Romo, who's his guy. And so he had all the pieces there, and I think he probably has a blind spot for Jason Garrett, and the urgency with which he needs to win now is filling that blind spot with like pure red rage.
Okay. Last question for you about this Cowboys game, and then we'll move on. What are the chances, what are the percentage odds, week one, 2020, Jason Garrett is the Cowboys head coach?
Well, I think it's like 3%.
Right. I was going to say 5. Like, it's in that range. I think this was, unless they go on a run, like you said, to the NFC Championship game, and they're competitive in the NFC Championship game, I have to imagine this is Jason Garrett's last year. This felt like it was the final straw for the Cowboys, but I thought he was going to get fired after the Titans game last year, so who knows?
Yeah, me too. And I have a hard time believing that Jason Garrett is – this team is very good. This team is not good enough to go on a deep playoff run without better coaching. Like, not in a not in a conference that has Sean Payton, Kyle Shanahan, Pete Carroll. I know Seahawks fans got hot about it. Pete Carroll's a Super Bowl winning coach. He's a good coach. And Mike Zimmer, who, for his, whatever Mike Zimmery he can be. I mean, like those are the, and potentially even Sean McVay thrown in there. Like, Jason Garrett's not going to just steamroll through this division because he's got better players or steamroll through this conference. He's going to have to outcoach somebody at some point, and he just refuses to do it.
Mm-hmm. So finishing up here, you had to bring up the idea that Jason Garrett was going to coach the Giants. I'll send it back at you, Will Brinson. Jason Garrett might be coaching the Carolina Panthers next year, because suddenly, after a rough stretch in the middle of the season with Kyle Allen not playing all that great, Carolina Panthers are 5-6. They are basically out of the playoff picture almost altogether. I think they'd have to run the table and then maybe catch a break to make the playoffs. They've lost 3 in a row after making it back to 5-3, lost the Packers, blown out by the Falcons, then losing a heartbreaker to the Saints in New Orleans yesterday, where Joey Sly missed an extra point, missed a field goal inside of 30 yards. I think it was the worst miss of the season in terms of the field goal expectation. It just a absolutely back-breaking, heart-wrenching performance. And Ron Rivera's job is in jeopardy with new ownership. And I wonder, Will, more so than the game itself, do you think Ron Rivera is in danger, and do you think he deserves to be in danger?
I think that those are two very different questions, Bill. And I'm going to plug my own podcast, but Jason Lockenfor and I talked about this, and he reported on it over the weekend, and he had some new information. Check out the Pick Six podcast. It's up Monday afternoon once you get done listening to Bill Barnwell's show. But it's fascinating. And, like, you know, I hear the same sort of things living in Carolina. And, I mean, basically, here's the deal is that, and I think that we knew this going into this. I'd heard the same sort of things going into the season, is that given Ron Rivera's status as a guy who was there when David Tepper bought the team, and it's someone who is not really on the same page as David Tepper. Like, David Tepper doesn't think he's a bad coach, but David Tepper wants to be really heavy on analytics. He's made that very clear in public statements. Ron Rivera is not that big into analytics. I know the Riverboat Ron thing was sort of a farce, really, if you want to boil it down. When we saw the Panthers lose that game, and with the Cam Newton status, Cam has still not had surgery on his foot, I am of the belief that he will not be fully recovered and fully trustworthy unless he has the, in terms of paying him $20 million, unless he has the surgery. Mm-hmm. And if he doesn't have the surgery, if he does that, it'll probably take him to like middle of March right now, if he had it today.
Right.
So the timeline for that is getting very dicey. And to me, it seems like there's a very good chance that this team loses out, that David Tepper will not look at this as a colossal failure that must be rectified, but instead an opportunity with the timing of Ron Rivera's contract, with the status of Cam Newton's contract, as a potential hard reset for the Panthers, a team that he bought 2 years ago for $2 billion and therefore can reset it anytime he wants because yes, he paid $2 billion for him. So I think that's where it's probably headed. With the Panthers not likely to make the playoffs, I think there's a very good chance that there's a separation. I don't think it'll be a bloodletting per se. JLC pointed out in the pod that he thinks the Tepper's analytics guys are going to use basically models to kind of say, here's who we think we should hire, whether it's in the college ranks. And, so it's not going to be like a Corn Ferry type of situation where you go, I mean, hey, give me 10 names and people you like. It's going to be an analytical approach to finding the next coach. And the logic that is that, David Tepper probably believes that he has a significant edge in being able to utilize those tools to find somebody who could develop the Panthers in a positive direction.
Yeah, I mean, this team is not far off by any means. This is a young, talented core here. I think Marty Herney has generally done a pretty good job in terms of drafting and developing players over the past few years.
In fact, you and I can collectively apologize to Marty Herney right now, because I know we've blasted him on this podcast before. I've done it on mine. I think since he came back, outside of the scope of working for Jerry Richardson, like once he got out from under Jerry Richardson, who forced him to do certain things in free agency and the draft, that Marty Herney's done a heck of a job in terms of stir accumulation.
100%. You know, and this would be a different team with a little bit more luck and with a healthy, productive starting quarterback. I mean, obviously, you know, the people who insisted Kyle Allen was as good as Cam Newton or better, they have quietly gone back into the dark areas of the Twitter sphere. That was just not a realistic proposition. And, you know, we don't know what we're going to get from Cam in 2020. But to me, I think the disconcerting thing as we finish up here is just the defense has been a problem. This is a defense that is 25th in points allowed. They're 17th in DVOA. There's a lot of talented players in this defense. They've had some injuries, but I mean, Ron Rivera basically went in over the offseason and said, hey, I'm going to fix this. We're going to get back to where we were, and I'm going to take more control and have that be how we get there. And that really hasn't happened. And I think you have to be concerned about that if you're David Tepper, because that's why you have Ron Rivera. I mean, as funny as it is to think about Riverboat Ron and that stuff, I mean, he has never shown a consistent aptitude for doing that. And he's not an offensive guy. I mean, his offenses have been mostly based on whoever the OC is. It was Mike Shula for so long, and now it's Norv Turner. I think the offense is okay. Obviously, Christian McCaffrey's great. They have a bunch of young talent there as well. But, you know, I think with either a good quarterback or an improved defense, this could be a playoff team. And I think it's easier to imagine them bringing in someone who's very good at working with quarterbacks, perhaps someone like a Kellen Moore, for example, and either bringing Cam back or signing a quarterback in free agency or drafting somebody and hoping that that turns into a upgraded quarterback on Kyle Allen, as opposed to trusting that Ron Rivera, who is a great defensive coach, can get more out of this defense than he has in 2019.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, the defense I thought it was a valiant effort by Ron to really knowing it was a situation where he could, and by the way, the Bengals are going back to Andy Dalton. Shocking news in the middle of R.I.P. Ryan Finley. The defense was really good out of the gates, and it looked like this creative front that Ron had sort of assembled, where it's like hybrid pieces of a 3-4 that is like comprised of mostly like, you know, bigger interior guys like a Gerald McCoy, a Kawan Short, a Dontari Poe, and then supplemented with Brian Burns and you know, Bruce Irvin on the outside. It looked like it was really going to work. Mm-hmm. And for, you know, as it turns out, when you have a bunch of pass rushing interior guys and a bunch of edge rushing guys, you know, like Irvin and Burns, that the gap integrity isn't always strong. And now the Panthers are terrible against the run. And so, like, I thought Ron did the best that he could with this team. You know, Cam going down, that kills you. And everybody knew that. They have if they went out, they have a 38% chance to make the playoffs per the Upshot simulator. So they are probably not going to be in the playoffs. I don't think they'll win out. That Saints game could have changed everything for them. You know, you lose the Falcons at home. That's a terrible, inexcusable loss. I mean, you just can't. I don't care if Dan Quinn's motivating his team. You know, you're the more desperate squad. And the Buccaneers in week two, they just had these games where, you know, look, it's the NFL. I mean, the ball bounces funny. Guys get hurt. Weird things happen. You know, Ron Rivera's had a great run in Carolina. It just feels like it could easily be a parting of the ways, not necessarily because he's not good. And I think he'll probably get hired almost immediately. Yeah, within 2 or 3 days.
I agree. I mean, I think he'll have a second job. I think he'll do well at that second job. But I do think it seems like at the very least it might be time for Ron Rivera in Carolina. Well, Will, of course, your annual monthly appearance is finished. Your obligation to the show is over. But until your next appearance, where can people check out more of the stuff you do?
If people like football podcasts, they should check out the Pick Six podcast. We do 8 shows a week now for some reason. The daily podcast with 8 shows. What a weird combination. Emergency podcast when breaking news happens. If Ron Rivera, if he gets fired, we'll do an emergency pod for that. Maybe I'll go record one for Andy Dalton. Getting his job back, but probably not. And on Twitter at Will Brinson and on CBSSports.com.
Will, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much, buddy.
Always fun, Bill. Talk soon, man.
All right. Thanks so much to my guest today, CBS's Will Brinson. And of course, if you haven't been checking out ESPN Daily with Mina Kimes, you're just being stupid at this point. go ahead and do that. Subscribe to ESPN Daily. I'm on it every Monday talking about the NFL. Mina has great guests on every day during the week. And of course, check out Will's podcast, the Pick Six podcast as well. But thanks so much for listening. Have a great holiday. We'll be back next week.